May it please the court. Today, the OCDC is here asking that this court discipline attorney Jonathan McDowell by imposing a suspension with no leave to reapply for at least 2 years. The underlying case in this matter involves Mr. McDowell's handling of an employment discrimination case. The OCDC alleged numerous violations, and the panel found those. I would like to touch on some of the more serious violations, explain OCDC's reasoning, and explain to this court why Mr. McDowell's arguments should carry little weight with this court. I'd like to start at the beginning. In this case, Mr. McDowell filed his complaint in federal court, and he alleged both the violation of the Missouri Human Rights Act and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We alleged that this was incompetence or did not show competence because state law, under at least at that time, the Missouri Human Rights Act, was much more plaintiff pro plaintiff. It had a much less causation standard. It was contributing factor as opposed to what the federal court required, which was much larger. There were less chance of granting a summary judgment. There were less restrictions on damages, and you did not have to have a unanimous jury verdict.
Have you found any case anywhere that convicted someone of misconduct on them, had to engage in misconduct because they made a strategy decision to file in federal court instead of state court, or in some other situation, state instead of federal? Is that the kind of thing, in and of itself, not addressing the other things you raised, that has ever been the subject of sanctions?
I am not aware of a case that specifically finds that filing in state court versus federal court is incompetent.
Lawyers make strategy decisions, and afterwards they're not always good. If this were a strategy decision, I know you have an argument that it wasn't. It was because the statute had been missed, and so that's an entirely different matter. But your argument concerns me that we would sanction someone because they made a bad strategy decision in a case, and most people wouldn't have done it in a single case as opposed to a pattern of misconduct.
I think that it was more than just a strategy decision. I think that in this case, the evidence showed that Mr. McDowell wasn't even aware that there were differences in the state law versus the federal law. I will also say that if you go, and I did do this, pull up cases under the federal district court where there has been both the Missouri Human Rights Commission and the Title VII pled, you will see that almost all of those are pro se cases. It's just not something that...
And in the Eighth Circuit, it's not considered very favorable. You might be in another circuit where it is, but aren't those all... those are all strategy things that may have been mistaken and may be even something that you talk to your malpractice carrier about, but I've never seen a single instance of it be a basis for discipline in itself without being connected to not knowing other rules, missing statute of limitations, misleading the court, and so forth, your other allegations.
Well, and I think you've got to look at this as a whole, too. This was not just this one violation. In this particular case, there were lots of things that went wrong. And I think when you look at it as a whole, then you've got to consider the competency issue,
absolutely,
too. Now, Mr. McDowell argues that it was that he filed in federal court because that allowed him to potentially get recovery under both Missouri Human Rights Act and under Title VII. I think that that's a bogus argument. If you look at the pleadings in the case, in both cases, Missouri Human Rights Act claim and the Title VII claim, as far as GoJet, the airline, it was the same facts. It was the same discrimination that was alleged, and it's the same damages that were sought. I can't envision that a court would allow a plaintiff to recover back pay under the Missouri Human Rights Act and then go and recover again that same back pay under the federal statute. Same thing with the front pay, the emotional distress, the punitive damages. They were all the same. And, you know, the purpose of the damages is to make the party whole. Again, it doesn't make sense to say, oh, I needed to file in federal court so I could recover under both.
Can you remind me of the other allegations that you made about the statute of limitations being missed before he filed in federal court and about misleading the court and misleading
yes.
and not communicating with his
yes.
client?
One of the other big issues was the Missouri Human Rights Act claim. There is a right to sue letter that comes out from the commission that says you have 90 days after the date of this letter to file your claim. There's a similar letter that comes out from the Equal Opportunity Commission. It came out on a different date. In this case, Mr. McDowell missed the statute of limitations under the state claim. It was 101 days after the fact when he did that. Now, he argued, hey, shouldn't have mattered because I thought that I could piggyback those onto the federal claim. I submit to you, why would any attorney that was acting in a competent and diligent way say, well, I'm going to just miss the statute of limitations and I'm going to hope that I can piggyback that onto another claim? That just doesn't make sense. A competent and diligent attorney would never, ever take that risk. I would also submit to you that he says, oh, I was looking at the case of Hammond versus Municipal Corrections Institute, which is a Western District case, and it references the Brown versus Continental Can Company case. He says, oh, that says that I can do that. I would ask that the court look at that Hammond case. I submit that the Hammond case does not say that. The Hammond case is very, requires strict adherence to the timelines in the Missouri Human Rights Act. And in that case, the attorney did even actually try to make an argument that's that same argument that Mr. McDowell made. And the court said, plaintiff fails to demonstrate how a right to sue letter issued by the EEOC could breathe life into a dead MCHR claim. That's the exact same thing that we have here. The reference to the Brown versus Continental case that's in there, which is a Ninth Circuit case, that dealt with a completely different issue. It dealt with two letters from the EEOC, right to sue letters, one for discrimination and training and one for discrimination and termination. And there, in that particular sentence situation, the court said, yes, you can piggyback them, but that's not what we had here. We had two letters from two different agencies. As far as the other issue was, in this case, Mr. McDowell filed his petition in federal court. He was not even admitted to federal court. He did not seek admission for 2.5 months after the court case was filed, and then did not get admitted for 5 months afterwards because he didn't have some of his paperwork in order. We have charged that as a competence and diligence issue, too. And Mr. McDowell says, well, what's the problem? I eventually did get admitted. Well, I don't think you can just look at that. It left his client in a very, very bad situation. It was only lucky that the court didn't go ahead and dismiss. I'd like to go then to probably the most important issue in this case was the statements he made to the court when the airline filed the motion to dismiss saying, hey, you didn't meet your Human Rights Commission statute of limitation on the 90 days. Mr. McDowell, and this is a direct quote from his pleading, said, therefore, plaintiff filed his pro se lawsuit within the time frame of his EEOC right to sue letter just 9 days after the MHRA deadline. It is easy to understand that the language of the subsequently received EEOC charge could have led a pro se litigant to believe that he was fulfilling everything required of him. And then he asked for equitable tolling of the statute of limitations. We asserted that was not truthful. He had been representing his client for over 2 years. He prepared the petition or the complaint. He decided what to charge in that. He decided when to file it. And in fact, he actually even drove the complaint to the federal court and filed it. So he was trying to cover up basically his mistake by saying, hey, plaintiff was pro se, didn't understand this. So
were there also other misrepresentations to the federal court?
Then later on, when he does get admitted, he says he needs additional time to study the pleadings because he's not familiar with them. And then when he asks for to amend his complaint, he also again says this was a pro se plaintiff and they were not aware of these particular issues when they filed the complaint.
What about the signatures?
The signatures? The panel asked him some questions about there was two cover sheets that had to be filed with the complaint at the time, and they looked similar to the client's signature, but not exactly the same. And the panel asked, did you sign those to the client? The client said, I signed the petition, but I did not sign these other two forms. So then when Mr. McDowell got on the stand, they asked him about that, and he said, yes, I did sign that, but I signed my own name to him. The panel kept asked for other instances when he had signed other documents. They compared it, did not believe that it was the same. They gave him multiple opportunities to correct that, and he continued to refuse to do that.
So he kept saying he signed his name, but in fact it looked like an A, and it looked like he had in fact signed his client's name
yes.
to it. And they found that he had lied about that.
Yes. And both of those forms he signed said that the person signing was affirming to the accuracy of that. So it would have been a problem if he had signed his client's name to that and not denoted that he was signing on behalf of his client.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Jonathan McDowell, respondent in this case. I'm going to kind of go with the way the informant's counsel started because some of the issues, and then we'll end up with issues she went through as well. If there's time for others, I'll expound on those. The very first thing about this case is it does have to do with strategy. Informant's counsel stated that she can't understand how you could get recovery under one cause of law and another cause of law with the same facts. They're independent causes of action. One is under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and one is under the Human Rights Act. They're completely independent causes of action. The fact that the facts that were relied on were the same doesn't preclude that you can recover under both. The reason that I filed in federal court were several reasons. One, my client said he wanted a quick disposition, and we knew that federal court had a quicker disposition than Missouri State Court. Many times in federal court, you have an early assessment program required settlement conference. And I told him that if we can get a settlement conference, maybe we'll get a quicker recovery. We won't have to go through the several years of litigation.
But what about the burden of proof was less at the state court level?
So the burden of proof, if you only have the Missouri Human Rights Act claims in Missouri State Court, then your burden of proof is not the but-for standard in Title VII cases. But if you file those Missouri Human Rights Act cases in federal court, that doesn't change the standard for what the law under the Missouri Rights Act is. So under the Title VII cases, you have a but-for standard for discrimination, and under the Missouri Human Rights Act cases, you have an and. So you still can have both causes of action with both.
Why wasn't it malpractice, though, to wait till after 90 days to file? And you also told your client you filed but didn't actually file until I think about 9 days later. Why weren't both those improper?
Whether it was malpractice, I'm not sure on. But the reason that I did it was exactly.
You purposely filed after the statute, or was it?
Well, I was aiming for the Title VII because that's what we originally were going to go with, was just the Title VII. But when we started looking at the Missouri Human Rights Act claims to file those as well, we put those in there because I thought that we could piggyback on those claims.
Why not file them timely for both?
I, because of the way that we were filing the petition, and I had other things going on as far as other caseload, and I was trying to, at that point in my practice, being a two-year attorney, three-year attorney, I was deadline-oriented and trying to hit these deadlines while maintaining my own firm. And it was just a matter of getting to the point of we needed to file the federal cases and can piggyback our Missouri human rights claims into that Title VII to make sure that the professional rules of conduct say that we don't have to press for every advantage of our client. And if, even if we would have decided not to file the Missouri Human Rights Act claims at all, we still had a cause of action for Title VII. We could have made the decision from a strategy standpoint was maybe we had a better decision from certain kind of judging of Title VII than we would have.
Did you ever have a discussion with your client that you were giving up the state claim?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Yeah, did you ever have a discussion with your client that you were giving up the state claim?
No, I didn't. I didn't understand that I would be giving up the state claim if I piggybacked those in. I thought that they would all be viable claims, that one wouldn't be stale or one wouldn't miss statute of limitations.
And the authority that you relied on was a Ninth Circuit case?
It was a quoted by the Western District. The Hammond case didn't get to exactly what I said we should do. I even said that in the brief. I said, this is what the Hammond case stands for. It doesn't get this far, but it looks like that we could do
and
this.
And if you read it, Ms. Riplinger is correct that it actually holds absolutely against you, that you have. It actually holds the other way from what you're saying.
Because I didn't get to what I was saying. So I said, you know, based on how this comes down, and on that Brown case, when you have an EEOC case claim, just of the facts related, you can piggyback those in. So that's where the Hammond case came in and why we really relied on the Eighth and Ninth Circuit federal law, because those were in the Hammond case and in the Brown case. And so even though the Hammond case didn't get quite to that point, it seemed like from the dicta from the Western District that it could have been triggered to that point.
I'm most concerned about the allegations that you misrepresented to the court, who had signed various pleadings that you misrepresented. You were not involved, and then it was pro se, and you tried to get an advantage in the litigation by saying you were newly in and didn't know about the filing. You needed time to get familiar with it, that you should excuse it, and so forth. And those were just not true, and misrepresenting the facts to the court is a very serious allegation.
Yeah, those are the most serious allegations. I think that has to be dealt with first and foremost, because if anything else, you know, it's what it is. But as far as those allegations, I did not misrepresent to the court in the brief that because he was a pro se complainant, he was confused. I said he could have been confused. My next argument right after that stated
you represented that he was a pro se.
That's right.
Petitioner,
and that's
he
right.
Wasn't.
Well, technically, he was pro se because he was the filer. I helped him with the complaint, but I didn't file as, you know, I didn't have my appearance entered when he filed, so technically he was a pro se plaintiff. Isn't that correct?
Well, that's the question.
Yeah, so I guess
that's
the
question. You were representing him.
Right, I was representing him, but as far as appearance in federal court, he was pro se, but I was representing him.
You were doing limited scope in that sense because you were not admitted, but you misled the court on that, and if that's how you treat all truths, that's even more concern. Do you think it's okay to do that, and you're still defending that as being a proper thing to represent to the court, when clearly the effect of it was to mislead the court into believing that he didn't have representation at that time and you were new, that leads to concerns that you're going to continue doing things like that.
I understand that, but I don't want you to think that I'm saying that I was trying to mislead the court, that I wasn't representing them. My name was at the top of the brief, even though he signed the name. Judge Flesig was not deceived in the fact that I was not representing him.
Well, what was the purpose of that statement, if not to create a mistaken impression by the court?
In the argument, is that what you mean? That led to my next point, that even if a person filed pro se with counsel, missed the deadline, they could piggyback. And that's where I went into the next point. Actually, at the end of that part of the brief, I said that is exactly what happened. I said that, you know, if a person files with the help of counsel, but pro se, and that's exactly what happened. I didn't say exactly what happened was that this person filed pro se without counsel's help. I said that he filed pro se with counsel's help, and it still gets us to the same point that you can piggyback that Missouri Human Rights Act claim to a Title VII claim.
So were you, like, under a limited scope representation?
For our client, it was a full scope, but he knew that I wouldn't be able to file until I had my federal court admittance. So he knew that I wasn't going to be filing, but I'd be entering later. Okay. As far as the other pleadings where the asking for the extension in time, I think it was the union filed a motion to dismiss for I don't even remember the name of the client, Bonafide something. I had never heard of that before. So to say to the court, I needed time to review the pleadings is an accurate statement, because I did need time to review the pleadings. As an attorney that I think at that point, I'd probably been practicing for 3 years, mostly employment claims, but not union claims. I did need time to review what that I don't remember what that cause of action or that dismissal was for, but whatever that was, I needed time to review that so I could properly refute those allegations and properly refute that motion to dismiss. And once I did have the time, we did file a response to the motion to dismiss, and the court did hold in our favor on that the bona fide claim was not proper. But I'd never heard of that before when I saw that, so I did need time. As far as the other, the extension of time, amending the plaintiff's petition, he was a pro se plaintiff when we filed. I never said that I did not help him file, but he was technically pro se as the signing filer. Judge Flesig knew it, you know, that I was representing him. That's some of the orders that came down, which I think she says in one of the orders that's in the record, that even though his name is on the top and the client signed, he was not representing him in court, even though he could have been representing him in a different capacity. I mean, Judge Flesig was aware of that. You can see that in the orders that are in the record. But as far as the amending the petition, once we had some of the cause of actions dismissed, when we amended the petition to add in, I believe it was like a 1984 claim, my client did not know about those claims that needed to be put in. The reason being is because I didn't know about those claims. Once we started going through discovery and started understanding the different facts of the case, I then found out about those claims that could be pulled in. And so when I told him and we decided to add those in the amendment, that is not an incorrect statement.
You had time to go through the discovery from the other side, but not to comply with the discovery request by the defense?
Well, we did comply with the discovery request. Our first set of discovery responses were objections, and they were made timely. Otherwise, they would have been waived.
Everything was an objection. You didn't answer anything?
The reason being is because the main objection was the number of discovery questions. The federal court had to be 25 or less, including all subparts. And so they were over that, so I objected to the entire set of discovery. Once we talked to GoJet, I said that I would file responses to certain discovery matters. They ended up drafting a motion to compel, sent it to me, so we got some of the discovery resolved. I still held on to some of the objections, even though I responded to other ones. And that's when we had a motions hearing on the motion to compel. So everything was timely as far as the discovery responses. I held back on some of them to protect my client's personal interest. And once we went to court on the motions hearing, some of my objections were sustained, and some of my objections were overruled, and we provided the discovery for it. So we did comply with discovery in a timely fashion. Otherwise, all the objections that we made at the beginning would have been completely waived. So the fact that those were sustained there at the end shows that we did comply. We ended up complying with what the judge required. And then there was a motion for attorney's fees. I think, I don't remember what the request was, for a $2,000 request. And Judge Flesig allowed $200 in attorney's fees to GoJet because they had prepared the motion to compel. And we don't have the court's record, the federal court's motions record on our record, but that's what it says. I think the order is in our record that says why that was provided, was the attorney's fees for the motion to compel.
Can you talk about your handling of the file after you left the firm and didn't leave any instructions about the case or the deadlines with any?
Yeah, I had a managing principal, Christy Crawford, that I would go over all of my cases with, including this one. And she wasn't officially the managing principal on this case, but I did have a set of cases that I reviewed with her and told her what was going on them, and including this one. And that was in the file. And when I left the firm had been on this case for several months. The signature block said Brown and James. They actually took over the fee agreement. So to say that I abandoned my client didn't make sense to me, because I abandoned all my other clients.
You brought this case in. You were the one handling it. Their evidence was nobody else knew anything about it, so you had an obligation to bring them up to speed. It wasn't like the other cases you may have handled for the firm that had been separately started by other people in the firm.
Right. And I did have discussions with Christy Crawford, so she knew that where we were at with the case because I had a deadline list and a punch list that I discussed.
Is that what she says?
Well, that's what I showed her in court. She said that she remembers the punch list, I believe. But I know I had the punch list in the file. And I know I spoke with her about that and other cases that
The day you resigned, there was something, exhibits were due to be filed. Is that correct?
That's right.
And did you make arrangements for those to be filed before you left the firm?
I did not.
And so part of your argument in your brief is that there was no misconduct because others in the firm stepped up and handled things and made sure that the client wasn't harmed by your behavior, but that's not the same thing as properly handling the case yourself, is it?
If I were on my own, then I completely agree with you. But with being at a large law firm that handles these type of cases and discussing this case with another attorney in my firm, my immediate supervisor, the deadlines were known. And because of what the information was in the case. So had I just left without discussing any of the case, I'd been the only attorney on it, no attorney knew anything about it, then it would be a different story. But in particular on this case, any case that they take on from the outside, you have to give a memorandum on the case, you have to provide the executive committee information, and they make the decision on whether they want to take the case based on the case itself. So the executive committee at least would have had to have reviewed this case, including some of the attorneys that worked on this case at
it's
a later date.
It's pretty exceptional they were able to step in and file something that same day, even if everything you say is correct, if they didn't know it was due on that day.
Yes, if they didn't know it was due and they didn't have access to the documents, that would be correct. But
and did the hearing panel find that they believed your version of how the case was handled, or did they believe the testimony of the other witnesses that you left without advising them of what the deadlines were and what was to be done?
Yeah, the hearing panel determined, it said that I was not credible on that, but the standard of review here is that you review all the evidence de novo and make the conclusions drawn on that in a disciplinary matter.
We have that ability, but we also are capable or may take the decisions and the findings of fact of the hearing panel that saw the witnesses.
I understand. But as far as the credibility of the witnesses, there were several things that were inconsistent. When you look at the record from Christine Vaporian in particular, and that's the person that testified to leaving the file not knowing anything about it, there were several times she said she knew all about the case is why she agreed to take the case, and then just a few minutes later she said she didn't know anything about the case until I left the firm or until they had a settlement conference. And so there were inconsistencies as a matter of when did they even know about the case. As a policy standpoint, I understand the allegations are serious, and especially with being the only attorney that handled the case at that firm. But one of the things that I question is if a new associate attorney, requests that a managing attorney help them with the case and they don't appoint somebody, does that exculpate the firm or managing attorneys from any of the misconduct that might arise from that, like in this case?
Counsel, I know you're out of time. If the Chief Justice doesn't mind, I want to just ask one more question. The DHP recommended indefinite suspension with no leave for reinstatement for 6 months. The OCDC is saying for 2 years. You're saying just dismiss the information entirely and no discipline should be imposed against you?
Well, if the court finds that no misconduct was, or I shouldn't say no misconduct, if the professional rules of conduct were not breached, then of course. But if the court finds that there are some misconduct or even like the most serious allegations, candor to the court, then I would say that reprimand would be the most that should have come on there, mainly because the aggravating factors and mitigating factors, and I think the mitigating factors weigh in favor of not going as far as suspension in this case. So if it is, let's say that the serious allegations are taken that it was misconduct, candor to the court, then suspension would be in order without mitigating factors. But with mitigating factors of being a very inexperienced attorney, under undue pressure, the other things that the ABA 611 looks to, then reprimand would be more appropriate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a few comments here. Mr. McDowell just told you that the client was aware that he had filed the complaint pro se because he was not admitted. That's not what the evidence showed. There is an email from Mr. McDowell to the client right before or at the time that he gets admitted where Mr. McDowell tells him, I had to file this as if you were pro se because I had not obtained admission to the court yet. That was long after the fact that it was the complaint was filed. Another issue that I wanted to just at least bring up was when you all asked him about why he put that he was pro se and, for instance, filing or requesting leave to file an amended complaint, he said, well, I didn't know about this stuff until I did discovery. My response to that is, well, if that's the case, why didn't you tell the court when requesting leave to amend, this was unknown to us until we completed discovery? That's not what he said. He said this cause of action was unknown to the pro se complainant. So I do think that he was misrepresenting to the court. As far as the issue of the other attorneys knowing anything about this case, he references a punch list. That is in the record. You will see that is a very minimal punch list. It has all the cases that he was working on, and there's two or three very general things like complete discovery, due interrogatories. There was not the specific dates that things had to be done, and that punch list had not been updated for I think that was done in April. He resigned in May. I didn't get the chance to talk about the discipline that we were requesting. We looked at the Kriegel case, which is the most recent case or opinion from this court where there have been misrepresentations to the court. And in that, there was a state suspension with probation. We do not think that that's appropriate in this case because he did make misrepresentations to the panel. Also, he is not admitting any wrongdoing to the panel or to us. Probation is not very effective when you have someone who is unwilling to learn and take guidance from someone else. So we believe that a two-year or a suspension with no leave to reapply for 2 years is more appropriate. Thank you.
The case will be submitted.